Good evening and welcome behind the news for January 23, 2003. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got one interview scheduled for tonight, and then at the bottom of the hour, we'll take some of your calls. It's been a long time since I did that, and certainly lots of news to chew over. The lingering recession, the mounting war cries, and many other things, of course. But first, we're joined in the studio by William Pepper, who is the author of the book An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, just published by Verso Press. And I'll say this at the end and at the bottom of the hour and also at the end of the show, but Bill Pepper is appearing at two events in New York City tonight. He will be at Riverside Church at 7 p.m., Riverside Church, of course, on Riverside Drive between 120th and 122nd Street. That's room 10T on the 10th floor of Riverside Church. Again, tonight, 7 p.m. at Riverside Church, room 10T on the 10th floor. And then a week from tonight, January 30th, 5 to 7 p.m., William Pepper will be the keynote speaker for a Black History Month event at Columbia University, Alfred Lerner Hall, 116th and Broadway. So that's a week from tonight at Columbia University. And tonight, at Riverside Church. And of this book, An Act of State, Coretta Scott King said, for a quarter of a century, Bill Pepper conducted an independent investigation of the assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. He opened his files to our family, encouraged us to speak with witnesses, and represented our family in the civil trial against the conspirators. The jury affirmed his findings, providing our family with a long-sought sense of closure and peace, which had been denied by official disinformation and cover-ups. Now the findings of his exhaustive investigation and additional revelations from the trial are presented in the pages of this important book. We recommend it highly to everyone who seeks the truth about Dr. King's assassination. Welcome to WBAI, William Pepper.
Thank you.
So first of all, tell us about your own history with Martin Luther King. How did you get to know him?
Well, I came to know Martin in 1967, and only knew him for that last year of his life. I had come back from Vietnam as a journalist. He read some of the work that I wrote, particularly a piece in Ramparts in January of 67. It was called The Children of Vietnam. And that piece upset him a great deal. I think mainly the photographs of burned and shrapnelized children, and more than anything else, and he asked to meet with me. We then talked about that war, and I opened all of my files to him, and at one point he actually openly wept. He was so distraught by what America was doing to this ancient culture. And he said he had to oppose the war and come out against it, and of course he did on the 4th of April 1967 in his speech at Riverside Church. Which one delivered 1 year to the day before he was assassinated. Then that last year, at his request, I became executive director of the National Conference for New Politics, which was an umbrella organization designed to counter the Johnson administration and possibly mount a third-party ticket of Martin King and Benjamin Spock.
And you write about the book that that meeting of that organization was disrupted, or was there some official handiwork involved?
Oh, yes, because we didn't know it at the time, Doug. You know, I guess we were marvelously naive then about those things, but they completely and thoroughly infiltrated the convention. The convention was one of the largest people's conventions ever held in the United States. There were over 5,000 delegates, came from myriads of organizations across the country. And the government infiltrated it through the establishment of a black caucus. It was the first black caucus to be established, and it was peopled by members of the Blackstone Rangers, certain poverty-funded organizers from Chicago, and they did a heck of a job in subverting the purpose of that convention.
So then the organization pretty much fell apart after that?
Pretty much, because the money was removed. What they did was to force through on the floor anti-Semitic resolutions to such an extent and degree that that so much money was withdrawn from the organization.
All right, let's move forward a little bit then, or sideways even. Certainly before his assassination, the government was obsessed with following Dr. King and discrediting him, and particularly the director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, was extremely obsessed with this. Could you talk a little bit about the extent of those activities?
Yes. Martin King was under surveillance all of the time. He was under electronic surveillance and physical surveillance, camera surveillance a good deal of the time. There were attempts to influence him in a variety of ways by putting plants in his own organization. There were enormous efforts on the part of the FBI to discredit him in every way that they could.
Going back how far?
Oh, I think they actually started targeting Martin King in the mid-50s, would you believe? But as we have learned since then, this is not unusual because the civil rights movement as such, and black leaders in particular, including Martin's own predecessors, were targeted by military intelligence back in the second decade of the 20th century. Around the time of the Russian Revolution, there was this belief that blacks were a natural seedbed for Marxist orientation and revolution.
This had to be the guilty conscience of the elite that was at work, right?
Oh, and so they had them under surveillance and infiltration, even at that early time, all the way through. So it was nothing new, but they then really intensively focused on King as the 60s dawned, and Ramsey Clark was actually the only attorney general that I know of who refused Hoover's requests to continue wiretapping. And when Ramsey refused those requests, Hoover then went directly to military intelligence, and they picked it up, and the Army was involved from then on.
Now, I know this is a stinking legalism, but isn't the Army prohibited from operating domestically?
Yes, the Army is prohibited from operating domestically in this fashion, as is the Central Intelligence Agency. But that has not seemed to be a barrier to covert operations.
And did the official hostility to King deepen when he came out against the Vietnam War?
Yes, it geometrically increased. And he lost, and SCLC lost millions of dollars in contributions and corporate contributions as well as individual contributions. And he became, of course, a person who was grossly unpopular with the establishment, and many of his own colleagues turned their back on him. His organization was somewhat divided by his insistence on opposing the war. He asked me to come to Ebenezer Baptist, and I thought he'd gone round the bend, frankly. He asked me to come to Ebenezer Baptist and address his congregation from the pulpit about why he had to oppose the war. And I looked at him, and I said, you know, these are your people. You want some honky kid from the north to come down and tell them what you must do? This is crazy, Martin. And he waved his finger at me and very admonished me, and he said, always remember this. He said, no, no, no. He said, you've been there. You've seen it. Now you've got to tell them why I must do what is right. and that shut me up.
I'm speaking with William F. Pepper, who is the author of An Active State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, just published by Verso. Okay, well, the official story is that James Earl Ray fired the fatal shot. Mm. Who was James Earl Ray?
James Earl Ray was an escaped convict who was on the run and was trying very hard to get out of North America and find his way to Europe and then actually into Africa because he just wanted to get as far away as he could from the United States. And he found.
And what was he in prison for?
He was in prison. James was always a petty a burglar and whole stick up artist, and he was in prison for robbery, attempted robbery. He was a very ineffective, inefficient thief and criminal. I mean, he carried five. He used to have five bullets in his pistol chambers rather than six. And when asked why he did that, and I asked him at one point why he did that, when I discovered that sort of eccentricity, and he finally had to admit that he always kept the firing pin empty because he was so clumsy he once shot himself in the foot. So he was very inept, really. And he was trying to get away, escape the country, and he ran into a chap in Montreal called Raoul, and he always only knew him as Raoul, who offered him some money and offered him travel papers and documents if he would hang around for a while and do some jobs for him. So James signed on, effectively, to running some things across the Canadian border and then the Mexican border, and being on a string and being fed money and waiting for these travel documents that never appeared, of course.
And do we know who this Raoul fellow was?
Yes, we do know who he is. In my view, we know who he is. We know where he is. He does not live very far from here, would you believe?
Maybe
and,
he's listening.
And in Westchester County, and he's been identified by not only James. And James was shown hundreds of photographs of people and never identified one. This is the first one he identified. This photograph. This photograph he identified in 1978. For the first time, and then he did it again, identified him again for me in 1995. So James identified him. Lloyd Jowers, who ran Jim's Grill, behind which the shot was fired, and who was involved in the conspiracy, has identified him as a man who was in the grill. He's been identified by Sid Carthew, who was a British merchant seaman, who was in the same bar in Montreal around the same time that James was, and was approached by this same guy in respect of selling guns to him. So there's been ample identification. Glenda Grabo, who knew Raoul when he was in Houston, Texas, involved in gun running with the Marcello organization, knew him, and has since, years later, spoken to him on the telephone. Identified.
So, some kind of organized crime figure? Is
that yes, he's a he's one of these characters who was bridged both worlds. He was associated with the Marcello organization in gun running operations into Latin America, but he also had an intelligence hat that he wore, and he was a key figure in all of these events.
And that's not an uncommon association. The intelligence and the mafia.
No.
We're supposed to believe that this incompetent petty criminal was the mastermind and executor of a complicated assassination strategy, which is kind of incredible in the face of it. What's your story? Who did kill King? And
well,
why?
Martin King was ultimately the victim of a mafia contract. It was picked up by the Marcello organization in New Orleans and passed on for implementation to Frank Liberto, who was one of Marcello's people in Memphis, Tennessee. Liberto was a produce dealer, and he effectively organized the on-the-ground activities in conjunction with the Memphis Police Department, and he went to Lloyd Jowers, whom he knew, and called in an old due bill from Jowers and also provided him with $100,000. And Jowers then was to play a specific role in terms of the killing. He was to be out in the bushes with the shooter. He was to take the gun at the end of the shooting and then hold it, keep it, and it would be picked up and taken away eventually. So Jowers played a key role. His place was the staging ground. It was right under the rooming house where Raoul was based, and where he had James rent a room on the afternoon of the killing.
So what was Ray doing on the afternoon of the killing?
He came into Memphis to the South Main Street address, having been in a motel on the fringe of town the night before, where he gave Raoul the gun. Raoul came by and picked up this throwdown gun that James had been instructed to buy, which he bought in Birmingham, Alabama. Then James came into town to the rooming house area on South Main Street around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, met Raoul there. Raoul instructed him to rent a room in the rooming house, which he did. And then Raoul went up to the room. James instructed James to bring some of his things up there, which he did in a bundle. And then he was out of the room most of the afternoon. Raoul kept him running around to look, buy a set of binoculars and do other things, but kept him out of the room. Martin King was shot at 1 minute past six at about 20 minutes past five, 25 past five. James went down to his car, and Raoul told him to leave the car because he might need it, but James remembered that there was a flat spare tire. He decided to try to repair it, so he then took off at around, I guess, 20 to 6 or so, about 20 minutes or so before the shooting. He drove away. He was seen driving away by two witnesses, and there were statements from these witnesses in the FBI 302 files and in the Memphis Police Department, Shelby County Prosecutor's files, and that's where I found them. But no one ever heard of these witnesses. They had been in Jim's Grill, had come out, had noticed the car, started walking up the street, got two blocks, saw the same car, and I looked at it fairly closely because one guy was thinking of buying a Mustang like that. And as they crossed the second street, Vance, the car came around the corner. So one had to pull the other guy back so he didn't get hit because the car was moving. And sure enough, it was the Mustang. And it was James, and it was about 15, 20 minutes before the shooting.
You initially believed the official story,
yes.
And then you met. Tell us how you came to change your mind.
Well, I never thought twice about it. When King was killed, I went to the memorial. Ben Spock and I together went to the memorial and then the funeral, and then I just walked away from politics and figured that. I mean, I was so disgusted with everything. I just finished with it, and 10 years later, Ralph Abernathy called me and said he wanted to visit James Earl Ray and asked me if I would interrogate him. And I was surprised because I said, I thought they had the right guy, Ralph. What's going on? And he said, well, I'd like to just go up and have him interrogated. I said, well, I don't know anything about the case. took me several months to get up to speed, and I did. And then we did eventually go up there, and I interviewed him for 5 hours. And put him through a rather rigorous time. And Abernathy and I both came away at the end of that interview believing that he was not the shooter. We didn't know what other role he might have played, but we believed he wasn't the shooter. But he raised so many questions from the official story, and he was so different a human being than one had read about. He was docile. He was a very gentle, soft-spoken, unassuming kind of guy.
And in the public image we get, he's like this racist redneck,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Ralph was adamant. He said, "This is not a racist. This man, any more than a working class kid from that kind of neighborhood, those neighborhoods in Illinois might be. But even when he worked in a shoe factory, he used to shoot craps after work with black guys. I mean, he was definitely not a racist. So." I then started to look at a lot of the issues he raised. As time allowed, I went into Memphis and I interviewed witnesses and started to collect evidence and started to analyze the case, because I became increasingly unhappy. And for the first time, starting to believe that perhaps there was a conspiracy here and perhaps this guy was being set up. But it took me 10 years to fully be convinced that James had no role in this other than as an unknowing patsy. And so in 1988, I agreed to represent him. He'd asked me over the years to do that, and finally in 1988, I agreed to represent him.
You published a book earlier on this subject, right?
Yes.
When was that?
1995, Orders to Kill came out, and that was the state of really the investigation up to that point in time. Act of State effectively summarizes, but yet then goes well beyond that, because we tried the case in 1999, and it was a 30-day trial with over 70 witnesses, and so much new evidence had been put under was put under oath at that point in time that it's effectively...
This was a mock trial with no legal force. Right?
No, this was a serious...
Oh, this is the civil case.
The civil trial.
Oh, the civil case.
We did the mock trial, as it's called, in 92, HBO and Thames Television mock trial in 92. And that jury was an actual, under criminal procedures, with a former federal judge and a former U.S. attorney prosecuting. Hickman Ewing was the prosecutor. And it took that jury 7 hours to find James not guilty.
Then what came out of the civil case?
The civil case just unraveled the whole, all of the evidence is there. And it's on the website of the King's Center. If anyone wants to read it, there are 4,000 pages of transcript. It set out the whole the factual basis of the killing and all of the critical details of the killing and the cover-up, how it took place and how it was covered up, how the Martin King's room was changed, for example, from a protected courtyard room to an exposed 306 balcony room.
This was kind of a last minute. When he checked in, he was told...
It's very interesting. Walter Bailey, there are two stories about how the room got changed. Bailey, on one hand, said he got a call from somebody at SCLC. And they said, it was shortly before the Wednesday when he arrived. It was, I think, the call was on Tuesday, something like that. And the person calling him said, Dr. King has to have this balcony room. Because he needs to overlook the swimming pool, which, of course, had no water in it anyway. But, yeah, he had to have this room. And Bailey said he protested and he wanted him to have the courtyard room. And so forth. That was one story. The other story was that Mrs. Bailey, who managed the motel, was paid a visit by someone around the same time. And that room change was done then. And when Martin King was shot... and went down. As soon as she heard this, I don't know how well this is known, Mrs. Bailey screamed at the switchboard, "My God, what have I done?" And she ran to her room and shut her door and locked her door and suffered a cerebral hemorrhage and was taken to the same hospital, St. Joseph's, that Martin was, and she died 5 days later.
Wow. I was speaking with William Pepper, author of An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, just published by Verso. And let's get to that subtitle. You mentioned a mafia hit, but asserting this was an act of state. So let's get Washington's involvement clear here.
Yes, go to motive if we could, Doug, and just because you asked about the war, and I think that was an important factor in the assassination of Martin King, his opposition to the war, because it was the end of that war was going to hit the bottom lines of a number of major corporations who were doing very well off the war. That's the first thing, but the real prominent reason, I believe, and the primary reason for his assassination was the Poor People's Campaign. He was going to bring 500,000 people to Washington. They were going to camp there, not a march. They were going to camp and go up and visit their elected representatives in the Congress and the Senate. Now, they were going to ask for the return to budget appropriations of funds that had been taken away because of the war. And there were literacy programs and health programs, educational programs. And they were going to seek these programs back. To be refunded. And Martin was bringing that mob there. Now, that terrified the government. across the board, they were terrified because they believed that there was no way, first of all, they were going to get those funds, those programs restored. And they believed the group would get angrier and angrier, and that eventually Martin King, the apostle of nonviolence, would lose control of that group, and it would be taken over by more violent minds and hands, and they would have a revolution on their hands. And they didn't have the forces to put down a revolution of that size in the capital. Westmoreland wanted 200,000. They couldn't give them to him. They didn't have enough troops. They were not going to be able, they believed, to contain the revolution that would result. So Martin King was never going to be allowed to bring that mob to Washington. That's basically what it came down to. Remember that year, 100 cities had burned in America. And remember, the Pentagon in autumn of 67 was put under siege by 200,000 people. And that devastated them. McNamara was up on the balcony ledge over looking at this, and he looked at the, he said to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Harold Johnson, he said, "Harold, you know, what are we going to do about this?" And he turned to the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence, and he said, "Bill, what are you going to do about this?" And he said, "Just give me the go-ahead, and I said, I'll take care of this problem." Now, that was in 67. That conversation was reported to me. In my opinion, that's probably pretty close to the mark. They were afraid that this would get out of hand. And so he was not going to be allowed to do it. Now, as a result of that fear and everything that had happened in America and King's increasing position and commitment to this march, there was established a task force, regular intelligence meetings across agency lines always anyway, but there was an actual task force established in the bowels of the Pentagon run by the 902nd Military Intelligence Group. And that group coordinated all of the activities around that led to the assassination. They also were involved in a joint venture with the Marcello organization, at least we can find out. On the sale of guns and weapons that were stolen from American armories and bases and trucked into Marcello's terrain and then shipped around the cove to Houston, where they were picked up, repackaged. And Glenda Grabo used to go down with Raul in the crowd, and sometimes she'd help them transport the guns back to the house where they were repackaging them before they were sent down. The Army would get 50%. 902nd would get 50% was what I was told, and Marcello organization would get 50%. They would split evenly the profits from the gun running operation. So they were involved.
But that was like the finance off the books covert
yes,
kinds of activities.
For black ops. Yes.
Uh-huh. Now, you also report on the presence of some special forces types in Memphis on that day. Could you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. A part of the overall plan was that there were two psychological operations officers on the roof of the fire station, which was diagonally opposite the Lorraine, who were photographing everything that was going on from about 1 o'clock that afternoon of April 4th. There were two cameramen who were photographing everything. There were a number of military intelligence officers spread around the city, and there was an Alpha 184 six-man Alpha 184 team in Memphis. And everything we've learned indicates that there were two snipers and there were two spotters with that team. They did not kill Martin King. The Army did not kill Martin King. He was, as I said, the victim of a hit, but mafia contract hit, but they were there as a backup, in my view. I think he was not going to be allowed to leave Memphis alive.
And there was also somebody who had Andrew Young in his crosshairs.
Yes,
one
of the snipers revealed to my liaison informant, who was a former naval intelligence officer and a journalist who kept running back and forth. These guys would not talk with me. They live in Mexico. They fled the country in the 70s because they thought there was going to be a cleanup operation. They're going to be killed. They fled. Steve Tompkins went back and forth to these people, taking my questions to them and their answers to me. And one of the things that one of the facts that emerged, one of the statements that emerged, was that both King and Young's photographs were shown at the 4:30 a.m. briefing at Camp Shelby. And both King and Young and one of the snipers was to take out Andy Young. Because they thought he potentially could have been a dangerous successor to Martin because he had credibility among northern liberals. He was always very adept at raising funds, and so Andy was to be have been taken out as well.
Future ambassador under the Carter administration. Right? We're just about, well, you have to let you go because you're going to be up at Riverside Church tonight at 7 p.m. A reminder to the audience to cut it there this evening, 7 p.m. at Riverside Church. There's this one-man industry named Gerald Posner who likes to debunk assassination theories. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about Gerald Posner in the last couple of minutes here.
Yeah, he's the most recent in a long list of, one might say, are government publicists. People who have just put out books related to supporting the state's case. I mean, it started back in 1968-69 with Gerald Frank and has continued all the way down. They had a string of people who've written on behalf of the state's case, and I think without doubt that Gerald Posner is the latest in that line. The only thing I can say about him and his work is that he has not interviewed ever 95% of the witnesses who testified at the trial in 1999.
Has he interviewed you?
No, he's never interviewed me. He's never interviewed James Earl Ray, and he never interviewed 95% of the witnesses. That's very important to understand that. When the state put its chief investigator on the stand, was called by the defense in the trial, they put their chief investigator on the stand, and I spent 15 minutes with him on cross-examination and went down a whole list of witnesses whom the jury had already heard testify as to how the assassination took place and how it was covered up. And I asked him one after another if he'd interviewed any of those witnesses. And he answered no to every single one.
But he, in his acknowledgments, says thanks the hospitality of the investigators in the courts, right?
Yes, they made him feel very much at home. He called it a second home, actually.
Yes, that was quite a revealing phrase. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for joining us, William Pepper, and the book An Active State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, just published by Verso. And I would love to have you stick around, talk some more, maybe talk to some of the listeners, but you've got to go because you'll be signing books and talking up at Riverside Church tonight, Riverside Church, 91 Claremont Avenue, 120th and 122nd Streets in Manhattan, and that's room 10T on the 10th floor. And we'll be back to take some calls at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900, after this word from Satoshi Tomy. From Satoshi Tomy's New Breed 006 mix. This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. My name is Doug Henwood, and the show is Behind the News. And this and all my shows are archived now on my website, www.leftbusinessobserver.com/radio.html. Go to leftbusinessobserver.com, and you will find it. Very easily. There's a link right up at the top of the home page there. And again, William Pepper will be speaking tonight at Riverside Church at 7 o'clock on the upper, very upper west side of Manhattan. And this book, as far as I know, is getting virtually no attention at all in the American media. No reviews, no news stories, nothing, even though it is very rigorously argued and it comes with the endorsement of the King family. Martin Luther King is, I guess, safe as a holiday, but as an actual historical figure, not much interest in his memory. So, please, some calls now. We have a lingering session on the verge of war. Plenty of things in the news. 212-209-2900. And let's take first call. Welcome to WBAI. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. Can we talk on anything in relationship to economics?
Well, yeah, within reason.
Well, two things. Yeah. First, I'd like get an understanding on this, you know, the stocks transfer tax that was upended by Koch in 87.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, it brought a lot of income to the city.
Yeah.
At that time, it was over $1 billion based on the volume of stock trade, which has excelled since then. Is there any possibility of us reenacting that tax?
Well, it's a very attractive one. We have to pay a tax when we buy, you know, just about everything in a retail store. But when big guys trade stock, they don't have to pay any taxes on it. But I don't know. I think the city of London imposes a stock transfer tax. But every time it's brought up here, the exchanges threaten to move out of town, whether it's New Jersey or into cyberspace or wherever. And I just don't know how real that threat is. If they were to move themselves, we have the New York Stock Exchange just down the street from where I'm sitting now, and if they were to move themselves across the river to New Jersey, they could beat the tax. I would much rather see it done at a national level where they couldn't escape from it. It's a tough bluff to call. It would be great to tax these guys, but they may just pick up and leave. So I don't know. I would like to see a lot more discussion and study of the matter, but I fear that the American elite is so tax-phobic, so reluctant to pay their share of anything. As my friend Ellen Frank, who was on the show a couple weeks ago, said, the American ruling class really doesn't want to not pay, not just doesn't want to pay taxes, they want to be paid tribute, and I think she's got a point there.
And the other question is hedge funds, which we know is a investment instrument of the rich. Are you ever going to have a program on that?
Never thought about it. I mean, hedge funds are basically high-end mutual funds that rich people and institutions put money into, and they get managed by high-end professionals and generally achieve very good returns for their investors, although they've not done so well in the last couple of years. They operate with lots of borrowed money, so they have tremendous power on the world markets, and they can move in and out of things with lightning speed. They can move in and out of whole countries and cause a lot of havoc when they're pouring their money in, and also cause a lot of havoc when they're pulling their money out. These are huge, unregulated, and largely unknown, unscrutinized entities.
And you have to be a millionaire to participate, right?
Yeah.
Close to a millionaire. You're not allowed by law.
Right.
You're a millionaire.
Yeah. They exist through a loophole in the regulations. I think it's if you have fewer than 100 investors, you can escape a lot of disclosure requirements that normal mutual funds have. And because they're considered very instruments for sophisticated investors, you have to have lots of money or be a institution like a pension fund or something like that. So it's only for very rich people and big financial institutions, and they're murky and very rich and generally deliver very good returns to their fortunate investors.
Okay.
All right, thank you. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for bringing Dr. Pepper on. I heard him also this week. What I want to ask you is, are you ever going to, or is there a gag order for WBAI not to have any discussions about the Illuminati, Judeo-Messianic Zionists?
Well, there is a gag order as far as I'm concerned, so please, let's take another call. Thank you. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello? Anyone there? No. Let's Got another call. And meanwhile, please give us a call, 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900, and you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I think I you had a program called the by Susan George, a book, The Lugano Report.
Right, yes.
On Preserving Capitalism in the 21st Century.
Yeah, that came a couple of years ago, I guess.
What that articulates to that book, I believe, articulates well to this reality. I think that the market economy is being used as a filtration device to weed out the fit as opposed to not fit. What's sort of like a Darwinistic, New Age version of Darwinism. My question to you is this. The U.S. financial assistance to the State of Israel, would you ever consider doing a program about that, financial aid?
Well, I've done several programs on the U.S. support of Israel and the Israeli political economy, its links to American interests and that sort of thing. So,
I hear $1.6 trillion since 1973, the cost of U.S. support for the State of Israel. $1.6 trillion.
Well, that's a lot of money. And your point?
My point is, what is the nature of this special relationship? Why are the Zionist Jews receiving so much support for the state from the United States taxpayers? I mean, has the U.S. political economy been co-opted by Jewish Zionist forces?
Well, I really don't like the sound of what you're saying, but I think the United States is not very easily co-opted by anybody and doesn't give its money to anyone who doesn't act in its interests. And the United States National Security Establishment has long held that Israel is doing important work for it in the Middle East, and it really doesn't have anything to do with sinister Zionist conspiracies. It has a lot to do with the imperial interests of the United States and its allies around the world, and Israel is a very important one of those allies. Next call. WBAI, you're on the air. Oops. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello?
Hi, Doug?
Yes.
Yeah, this is John from the Bronx. Great show, great guest.
Thank you.
I was wondering if there is the possibility of ever having a discussion about having a national lottery that would be able to take care of a lot of the debt load that the common taxpayer has to shoulder and maybe be administered by Angela Mayo, Coretta Scott King, and throw Jimmy Carter in there and Rudy, you know, to balance it or something. But a national lottery that would be able to absorb a lot of the national debt and a lot of the other perhaps the provisions that we could make for education and things like that.
Well, the bad thing about a national lottery is that people who buy lottery tickets tend to be poorer on average, and the lottery, you know, although somebody hits it now and then, basically you're just throwing your money away when you buy a lottery ticket. And someone once put it, a lottery is a tax on gullibility, and I'm afraid that that applies. So I think a national lottery would be a very bad idea. It takes money from the pockets of people who are generally least able to spare any money. So thanks for
that. That's why I mean... that it would be given back, and a national sort of return back to the taxpayer. It would be used only to be given back to those who would need it, or given back to the country for other particular ways to use it, such as education and things like that. Because, I mean, the winner itself doesn't have it as a total amount, there's always very much more that was left over.
Well, thank you, but I think, like I said, the people who buy the lottery tickets are generally people who can't afford it, and no matter how virtuous the spending of the proceeds, can't compensate for the fact that it's the poorer folks who buy the tickets, and I think we be much better off taxing rich people who have more money than they know what to do with. Okay, let's take another call. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi. I've subscribed to Left Business Observer for a long time and listened to the show for a long time, and while I find your analyses, your critical analyses, very insightful, I have rarely heard you give prescriptions as to what kind of economic reorganization is viable, whether in a large sense of market socialism or nationalized industry, or even in a more immediate sense of dealing with the kinds of ideas of Jeff Madrick or Paul Krugman in the New York Times all the time. And I miss that. I think that you could offer a lot and would like to see programs that are not just critical analyses, but give people a basis upon which to organize.
Well, wow, you got me at a weak point because I don't really know a lot of answers to those sorts of questions. It's not easy to think about the alternatives to this the pig system we live under. I think, although I certainly made it clear over the years that I think that we'd be better off with a much more generous welfare state than we have in this country, more generous income support, the standard social democratic package of universal health care, universal free education, universal free child care, those sorts of things. And, over the longer term, I would love to, I think I still...
But you're as aware as anybody of the contradictions that would bring in terms of the effect that it would have in a capitalist economy. I'm not asking for anyone to give all the answers. I don't think anybody has all the answers. But I would hope that this would be a program, since there are none other on VAI, which especially are hosted by someone with the extent of economic knowledge that you have, that this would be a forum for those kinds of discussions, and we can try and muddle through this together, because nobody else is trying to do that, and that's what I, for one, looked at BAI for, and have found it sorely lacking, perhaps since the days of Leo Cawley or Bill Tabb's programs 20 years ago.
Well, that is a very good suggestion, and I think I'll try to take you up on it. Thank you.
I appreciate that.
Thank you. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello. As a prescription for finding out what to do about all these things, starting with the King assassination and the Kennedy assassination, the Congress found in 1979 that the Kennedy assassination was a plot, and you reminded us today that the King assassination has been officially found by the court system in certain senses as a plot, both of which are unsolved. If there could be put together a TV show, a la what has been done with Bowling for Columbine and so on, in documentary fashion, that goes back to these original crimes as well as the election in Florida, which is another unsolved crime, attacking the bases of this system along these lines, a legal line combined with a television show kind of approach, when the rottenness of the basic system can be seen to be credibly attacked on a strong legal basis. It'd be a form of sort of counter impeachment of the whole system, as well as, I guess, apparently there's some role for the current Bush administration, certainly in the last election situation, where the newspaper investigation in this case has found that was totally falsified. And through this kind of a public reopening of these unsolved basic crimes that essentially supported the whole system, then there could be, after the indictment of the system, people become far more aware of the system. Look, a national debate will come in to work out what the alternatives can be once they understand that this thing has to be replaced punished and replaced. You've got to start with the media and television, essentially, and should work towards some kind of project like that that will do this. And maybe you start with Michael Moore and maybe a couple other people, put together a coalition of people that will – it gets back also to – I don't know if you remember Lord Russell back during the Vietnam War, and in essence indicted Johnson in the war in a foreign mock forum, maybe a mock impeachment based on these unsolved crimes or something like that can be started.
What you say is has some appeal, but unfortunately, I don't think that we could find a TV station that broadcasts such a documentary.
Well,
this Pepper book, for example, is even getting reviewed, and the idea that we're going to have some sort of detailed investigation.
It has found incredible sales. It's been on the Times bestseller list for a long time. I'm talking now, of course, about the Moore book, that's the point. Do it on television somehow. I realize it's a tough job, but to get a truly liberal forum going that would reach into the media and somehow project all this forward, The Moore book has sold so well. The movie has sold so well. There's a tremendous audience out there for it. This kind of approach, and simply change the focus and onto these, start up where the King investigations and the Kennedy investigations ended. You know, it's interesting that in the Kennedy case, Congress told the executive in the 79 final hearings on the assassinations that there was a plot, there was a conspiracy, and that the executive should go reinvestigate it again in 1980. And, of course, that's when Reagan was elected, and, of course, the whole thing got shot down and forgotten.
All right. Well,
but, you know, revive all these things. There's a tremendous non-nut basis, completely legally investigated basis for going right after the basis of the whole economic system in the end, but political as well, and on the basis of these kinds of crimes.
Well,
that have kept it in power.
Yeah, we've got a full
call
here, so thanks for your suggestion. But like I say, I'm really skeptical that you could ever get somebody to broadcast anything remotely like that. WBAI, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. Did you consider having Bonnie Brown on of a city budget?
I had her on about 6 weeks ago, maybe.
Yeah, because what I'm looking for, Bill, is with regard to the stock transfer tax and just the whole shift. I can't get people to really understand how much they're paying for just being allowed, quote unquote, to live in New York. And what I'm finding is that now middle class people, especially with the rents going up the way they're going, are going into like culture shock. And it's really difficult, unless, quote unquote, you're going through it, to convince people that the transit fare is a tax and the some of the other things that we've just gotten used to. And what I liked about Ms. Brower's analysis was that she was talking about all these taxes on businesses, large banks, and that haven't changed since like the turn of the century.
Turn of which century?
I'm sorry. Turn of the last century.
Yeah.
In the 20s and teens. She said something like the large banks pay something like $100 for some esoteric tax.
Oh, yeah. They're extremely low rates.
And the other piece is that people, I don't think they really understand, quote, unquote, while they're talking about cutting taxes. I've never paid so much tax since they started cutting my tax. I mean, I was better off when Jimmy Carter had 20... You know, that crazy inflation and all of that?
Yeah.
Well, the economy was in free fall. People had money.
Well, Republicans, who remain are the ones who talk about cutting taxes, always talk about cutting income taxes. And they want to cut income taxes because that's the ones that rich people pay the highest share of. They don't talk about cutting Social Security taxes because 70-80% of American workers pay more in Social Security tax than they pay in income tax. They don't talk about that. That's, you know, it's because that's a tax on workers.
Well, how can we get... maybe this is an inappropriate question to ask you, but I mean, how does one go about, you know, like, really fostering, quote unquote, the revolution around just getting people to understand that you're going to pay one way or the other? Are you? It's similar to the quote that I think Mr. Pepper had in his book by James Bevel. You're going to give me your son one way or the other. You can either give it to Johnson or you can give it to King. You can either give the money to yourself so that you can have better transportation, hospitals, et cetera, or are you going to give it to, I don't know, I don't like to use this term, but Bill Gates because he's got so much, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or are you going to give it to, I mean, I just heard Cynthia McKinney.
Or our mayor who's got, what, $5 billion at the bank, right?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to beat up on Bloomberg right now because
Giuliani
was so yucky. I mean, I think that Bloomberg is just trying to figure out a way to make a name for himself and can't figure it out. But he's a business person, right? Is there any way that we can appeal to him on the business level, or has he sold out because of, you know, the Republican connection, and he's just trying to hold it together? I'm trying to look for a way to wake folks up so that they will stop being so willing to participate in their own demise and yet want to cry about how horrible their lives are.
Well,
good luck.
Yeah, good luck. We're just about out of time, so we'll have
Thank
to. Yours is the last call, but
Bill Tab back on too.
Yeah, that's
Bye-bye.
A good idea. I guess Bloomberg is about as decent as billionaires come, and they're not going to come much better than that. But he's still not going to tax his ilk very heavily. It's a lonely job trying to agitate, educate, and organize because the public is buried in a fog of misunderstanding and alienation and confusion and even despair sometimes about changing the way things are. You can't fight City Hall, as they say, and that's just a deeply ingrained attitude in the American public. We like to think of ourselves as a nation of rugged individualists, but in fact, we're anything but that. And I'm afraid I have to bring it to a close there. Sorry to all you who are still on the line. We didn't get to your calls. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and I'll be back next week. And let's go out with a little bit a remix of a song by the Russian lesbian teeny bopper pop duo Tattoo. This is the song Robot. I am a